If I could leave you with one big idea today, it's that the whole of the data in which we consume is greater than the sum of the parts. And instead of thinking about information overload, what I'd like you to think about is how we can use information so that patterns pop and we can see trends that would otherwise be invisible. So what we're looking at right here is a typical mortality chart organized by age. This tool that I'm using here is a little experiment. It's called Pivot. And with Pivot, what I can do is I can choose to filter on one particular cause of death, say accidents. And right away, I see there's a different pattern that emerges. This is because in the mid area here, people are their most active, and over here, they're most frail. We can step back out again and then reorganize the data by cause of death, seeing that circulatory diseases and cancers are the usual suspects, but not for everyone. If we go ahead and we filter by age, say 40 years or less, we see that accidents are actually the greatest cause that people have to be worried about. And if you drill into that, it's especially the case for men. So you get the idea that viewing information, viewing data in this way, is a lot like swimming in a living information infographic. And if we can do this for raw data, why not do it for content as well? So what we have right here is the cover of every single Sports Illustrated ever produced. It's all here. It's all on the web. You can go back to your rooms and try this after my talk. With Pivot, you can drill into a decade. You can drill into a particular year. You can jump right into a specific issue. So I'm looking at this. I see the athletes that have appeared in this issue, the sports. I'm a Lance Armstrong fan. So I'll go ahead and I'll click on that, which reveals for me all the issues in which Lance Armstrong's been a part of. Now, if I want to just kind of take a peek at these, I might think, well, what about taking a look at all of cycling? So I can step back and expand on that. And I see Greg LeMond now. And so you get the idea that when you navigate over information this way, going narrow, broader, backing in, backing out, you're not searching, you're not browsing. You're doing something that's actually a little bit different. It's in between, and we think it changes the way information can be used. So I want to extrapolate on this idea a bit with something that's a little bit crazy. What we've done here is we've taken every single Wikipedia page and we reduced it down to a little summary. So the summary consists of just a little synopsis and an icon to indicate the topical area that it comes from. I'm only showing the top 500 most popular Wikipedia pages right here. But even in this limited view, we can do a lot of things. Right away, we get a sense of what are the topical domains that are most popular in Wikipedia. I'm going to go ahead and select government. Now, having selected government, I can now see that the Wikipedia categories that most frequently correspond to that are Time Magazine People of the Year. So this is really important because this is an insight that was not contained within any one Wikipedia page. It's only possible to see that insight when you step back and look at all of them. Looking at one of these particular summaries, I can then drill into the concept of Time Magazine Person of the Year, bringing up all of them. So looking at these people, I can see that the majority come from government. Some have come from natural sciences. Some, fewer still, have come from business. There's my boss. And one has come from music. And interestingly enough, Bono is also a TED Prize winner. So we can go jump and take a look at all TED Prize winners. So you see, we're navigating the web for the first time as if it's actually a web, not from page to page, but at a higher level of abstraction. And so I want to show you one other thing that may catch you a little bit by surprise. I'm just showing the New York Times website here. So pivot this application. I don't want to call it a browser. It's really not a browser, but you can view web pages with it. And we bring that zoomable technology to every single web page like this. So I can step back, pop right back into a specific section. Now, the reason why this is important is because by virtue of just viewing web pages in this way, I can look at it in my entire browsing history in the exact same way. So I can drill into what I've done over specific time frames. Here, in fact, is the state of all the demo that I just gave. And I can sort of replay some stuff that I was looking at earlier today. And if I want to step back and look at everything, I can slice and dice my history, perhaps by my search history. Here I was doing some nepotistic searching, looking for Bing. Over here for Live Labs Pivot. And from these, I can drill into the web page and just launch them again. It's one metaphor repurposed multiple times, and in each case, it makes the whole greater than the sum of the parts with the data. So right now, in this world, we think about data as being this curse. We talk about the curse of information overload. We talk about drowning in data. What if we can actually turn that upside down and turn the web upside down so that instead of navigating from one thing to the next, we get used to the habit of being able to go from many things to many things and then being able to see the patterns that were otherwise hidden? If we can do that, then instead of being trapped in data, we might actually extract information. And instead of dealing just with information, we can tease out knowledge. And if we get the knowledge, then maybe there's wisdom to be found. So with that, I thank you. Thank you.
I'm Jamie Menville. I'm a game designer. I've been making games online now for 10 years, and my goal for the next decade is to try to make it as easy to save the world in real life as it is to save the world in online games. Now, I have a plan for this, and it entails convincing more people, including all of you, to spend more time playing bigger and better games. Right now, we spend 3 billion hours a week playing online games. Some of you might be thinking, that's a lot of time to spend playing games, maybe too much time, considering how many urgent problems we have to solve in the real world. But actually, according to my research at the Institute for the Future, it's actually the opposite is true. 3 billion hours a week is not nearly enough gameplay to solve the world's most urgent problems. In fact, I believe that if we want to survive the next century on this planet, we need to increase that total dramatically. I've calculated the total we need at 21 billion hours of gameplay every week. So that's probably a bit of a counterintuitive idea, so I'll say it again, let it sink in. If we want to solve problems like hunger, poverty, climate change, global conflict, obesity, I believe that we need to aspire to play games online for at least 21 billion hours a week by the end of the next decade. No, I'm serious. I am. Here's why. This picture pretty much sums up why I think games are so essential to the future survival of the human species. Truly. This is a portrait by a photographer named Phil Toldano. He wanted to capture the emotion of gaming. So he set up a camera in front of gamers while they were playing. And this is a classic gaming emotion. Now, if you're not a gamer, you might miss some of the nuance in this photo. You probably see the sense of urgency, a little bit of fear, but intense concentration, deep, deep focus on tackling a really difficult problem. If you are a gamer, you will notice a few nuances here. The crinkle of the eyes up and around the mouth is a sign of optimism. And the eyebrows up is surprise. This is a gamer who's on the verge of something called an epic win. Now, oh, you've heard of that. Okay, good. So we have some gamers among us. So an epic win is an outcome that is so extraordinarily positive, you had no idea it was even possible until you achieved it. It was almost beyond the threshold of imagination. And when you get there, you're shocked to discover what you're truly capable of. That's an epic win. This is a gamer on the verge of an epic win. And this is the face that we need to see on millions of problem solvers all over the world as we try to tackle the obstacles of the next century. The face of someone who, against all odds, is on the verge of an epic win. Now, unfortunately, this is more of the face that we see in everyday life now as we try to tackle urgent problems. This is what I call the I'm not good at life face. And this is actually me making it. Can you see it? Yes, good. This is actually me making the I'm not good at life face. This is a piece of graffiti in my old neighborhood in Berkeley, California, where I did my PhD on why we're better in games than we are in real life. And this is a problem that a lot of gamers have. We feel that we are not as good in reality as we are in games. And I don't mean just good as in successful, although that's part of it. We do achieve more in game worlds. But I also mean good as in motivated to do something that matters, inspired to collaborate and to cooperate. And when we're in game worlds, I believe that many of us become the best version of ourselves, the most likely to help at a moment's notice, the most likely to stick with a problem as long as it takes to get up after failure and try again. And in real life, When we face failure, when we confront obstacles, we often don't feel that way. We feel overcome. We feel overwhelmed. We feel anxious, maybe depressed, frustrated, or cynical. We never have those feelings when we're playing games. They just don't exist in games. So that's what I wanted to study when I was a graduate student. What about games makes it impossible to feel that we can't achieve everything? How can we take those feelings from games and apply them to real-world work? So I looked at games like World of Warcraft, which is really the ideal collaborative problem-solving environment. And I started to notice a few things that make epic wins so possible in online worlds. So the first thing is, whenever you show up in one of these online games, especially in World of Warcraft, there are lots and lots of different characters who are willing to trust you with a world-saving mission right away. But not just any mission. It's a mission that is perfectly matched with your current level in the game. right? So you can do it. They never give you a challenge that you can't achieve, but it is on the verge of what you're capable of. So you have to try hard. But there's no unemployment in World of Warcraft. There's no sitting around wringing your hands. There's always something specific and important to be done. And there are also tons of collaborators everywhere you go, hundreds of thousands of people ready to work with you to achieve your epic mission. That's not something we have in real life that easily, the sense that at our fingertips are tons of collaborators. And also there's this epic story, this inspiring story of why we're there and what we're doing. And then we get all this positive feedback. You guys have heard of leveling up and plus one strength and plus one's intelligence. We don't get that kind of constant feedback in real life. When I get off the stage, I'm not going to have, you know, plus one speaking and plus one crazy idea, plus 20 crazy idea. I don't get that feedback in real life. Now, the problem with collaborative online environments like World of Warcraft is that it's so satisfying to be on the verge of an epic win all the time that we decide to spend all our time in these game worlds. It's just better than reality. So far, collectively, all the World of Warcraft gamers have spent 5.93 million years solving the virtual problems of Azeroth. Now, that's not necessarily a bad thing. It might sound like it's a bad thing. But to put that in context, 5.93 million years ago was when our earliest primate human ancestors stood up. That was the first upright primate, okay? So when we talk about how much time we're currently investing in playing games, the only way it makes sense to even think about it is to talk about time at the magnitude of human evolution, which is an extraordinary thing, but it's also apt because it turns out that by spending all this time playing games, we're actually changing what we are capable of as human beings. We're evolving to be a more collaborative and hardy species. This is true. I believe this. So consider this really interesting statistic. It was recently published by a researcher at Carnegie Mellon University. The average young person today in a country with a strong gamer culture will have spent 10,000 hours playing online games by the age of 21. Now, 10,000 hours is a really interesting number for two reasons. First of all, for children in the United States, 10,080 hours is the exact amount of time you will spend in school from fifth grade to high school graduation if you have perfect attendance. So we have an entire parallel track of education going on where young people are learning as much about what it takes to be a good gamer as they're learning about everything else in school. Now, some of you have probably read Malcolm Gladwell's new book, Outliers. So you would have heard of his theory of success, the 10,000 hours theory of success. It's based on this great cognitive science research that if we can master 10,000 hours of effortful study at anything by the age of 21, we will be virtuosos at it. We will be as good at whatever we do as the greatest people in the world. And so now what we're looking at is an entire generation of young people who are virtuoso gamers. So the big question is, what exactly are gamers getting so good at? Because if we could figure that out, we would have a virtually unprecedented human resource on our hands. This is how many people we now have in the world who spend at least an hour a day playing online games. These are our virtuoso gamers, 500 million people who are extraordinarily good at something. And in the next decade, we're going to have another billion gamers who are extraordinarily good at whatever that is. If you don't know it already, this is coming. The game industry is developing consoles that are low energy and that work with the wireless phone networks instead of broadband internet so that gamers all over the world, particularly in India, China, Brazil, can get online. They expect 1 billion more gamers in the next decade. So it brings up to 1.5 billion gamers. So I've started to think about what these games are making us virtuosos at. Here are the four things I came up with. The first is urgent optimism. Okay, think of this as extreme self-motivation. Urgent optimism is the desire to act immediately to tackle an obstacle combined with the belief that we have a reasonable hope of success. Gamers always believe that an epic win is possible and that it's always worth trying and trying now. Gamers don't sit around. Okay, gamers are virtuosos at weaving a tight social fabric. There's a lot of interesting research that shows that we like people better after we play a game with them, even if they've beaten us badly. And the reason is it takes a lot of trust to play a game with someone. We trust that they will spend their time with us, that they will play by the same rules, value the same goal, they'll stay with the game until it's over. And so playing a game together actually builds up bonds and trust and cooperation, and we actually build stronger social relationships as a result. blissful productivity. I love it. You know, there's a reason why the average World of Warcraft gamer plays for 22 hours a week, kind of a half-time job. It's because we know when we're playing a game that we're actually happier working hard than we are relaxing or hanging out. We know that we are optimized as human beings to do hard, meaningful work. And gamers are willing to work hard all the time if they're given the right work. Finally, epic meaning. Gamers love to be attached to awe-inspiring missions, to human planetary scale stories. So just one bit of trivia that helps put that into perspective. So you all know Wikipedia, biggest wiki in the world. Second biggest wiki in the world, with nearly 80,000 articles, is the World of Warcraft Wiki. 5 million people use it every month. They have compiled more information about World of Warcraft on the internet than any other topic covered on any other wiki in the world. They are building an epic story. They are building an epic knowledge resource about the World of Warcraft. Okay, so these are four superpowers that add up to one thing. Gamers are super empowered, hopeful individuals. These are people who believe that they are individually capable of changing the world. And the only problem is they believe that they are capable of changing virtual worlds and not the real world. That's the problem that I'm trying to solve. There's an economist named Edward Castronova whose work is brilliant. He looks at why people are investing so much time and energy and money in online worlds. And he says we're witnessing what amounts to no less than a mass exodus to virtual worlds and online game environments. And he's an economist, so he's rational. And he says, not like me, I'm a game designer, I'm exuberant. But he says that this makes perfect sense. Because gamers can achieve more in online worlds than they can in real life. They can have stronger social relationships in games than they can have in real life. They get better feedback and feel more rewarded in games than they do in real life. So he says, for now, it makes perfect sense for gamers to spend more time in virtual worlds than the real world. Now, I also agree that that is rational for now, but it is not by any means an optimal situation. We have to start making the real world work more like a game. So I take my inspiration from something that happened 2,500 years ago. These are ancient dice made out of sheep's knuckles, right? Before we had awesome game controllers, we had sheep's knuckles. And these represent the first game equipment designed by human beings. And if you're familiar with the work of the ancient Greek historian Herodotus, you might know this history, which is the history of who invented games and why. Herodotus says that games, particularly dice games, were invented in the kingdom of Lydia during a time of famine. Apparently, there was such a severe famine that the king of Lydia decided they had to do something crazy. People were suffering. People were fighting. It was an extreme situation. They needed an extreme solution. So, according to Herodotus, they invented dice games, and they set up a kingdom-wide policy. On one day, everybody would eat, and on the next day, everybody would play games. And they would be so immersed in playing the dice games, because games are so engaging and immerse us in such satisfying, blissful productivity, they would ignore the fact that they had no food to eat. And then on the next day, they would play games. And on the next day, they would eat. And according to Herodotus, they passed 18 years this way, surviving through a famine by eating on one day and playing games on the next. Now, this is exactly, I think, how we're using games today. We're using games to escape real-world suffering. We're using games to get away from everything that's broken in the real environment, everything that's not satisfying about real life, and we're getting what we need from games. But it doesn't have to end there. This is really exciting. According to Herodotus, after 18 years, the famine wasn't getting better, so the king decided they would play one final dice game. They divided the entire kingdom in half. They played one dice game. And the winners of that game got to go on an epic adventure. They would leave Lydia, and they would go out in search of a new place to live, leaving behind just enough people to survive on the resources that were available, and hopefully to take their civilization somewhere else where they could thrive. Now, this sounds crazy, right? But recently, DNA evidence has shown that the Etruscans, who then led to the Roman Empire, actually share the same DNA as the ancient Lydians. And so, recently, scientists have suggested that Herodotus' crazy story is actually true, and geologists have found evidence of a global cooling that lasted for nearly 20 years that could have explained the famine. So this crazy story might be true. They might have actually saved their culture by playing games, escaping to games for 18 years, and then been so inspired and knew so much about how to come together with games that they actually saved the entire civilization that way. Okay, we can do that. We've been playing Warcraft since 1994. That was the first real-time strategy game from the World of Warcraft series. That was 16 years ago. They played dice games for 18 years. We've been playing Warcraft for 16 years. I say we are ready for our own epic game. Now, they had half the civilization go off in search of a new world. So that's where I get my 21 billion hours a week of gameplay from. Let's get half of us to agree to spend an hour a day playing games until we solve real world problems. Now, I know you're asking, how are we going to solve real world problems in games? Well, that's what I have devoted my work to over the past few years at the Institute for the Future. We have this banner in our offices in Palo Alto, and it expresses our view of how we should try to relate to the future. We do not want to try to predict the future. What we want to do is make the future. We want to imagine the best case scenario outcome, and then we want to empower people to make that outcome a reality. We want to imagine epic wins and then give people the means to achieve the epic win. I'm just going to very briefly show you three games that I've made that are an attempt to give people the means to create epic wins in their own futures. So this is World Without Oil. We made this game in 2007. This is an online game in which you try to survive an oil shortage. The oil shortage is fictional, but we put enough online content out there for you to believe that it's real and to live your real life as if we've run out of oil. So when you come to the game, you sign up, you tell us where you live, and then we give you real-time news videos, data feeds that show you exactly how much oil costs, what's not available, how food supply is being affected, how transportation is being affected, if schools are closed, if there's rioting, and you have to figure out how you would live your real life as if this were true. And then we ask you to blog about it, to post videos, to post photos. We piloted this game with 1,700 players in 2007, and we've tracked them for the 3 years since. And I can tell you that this is a transformative experience. Nobody wants to change how they live just because it's good for the world or because we're supposed to. But if you immerse them in an epic adventure and tell them, we've run out of oil, this is an amazing story and adventure for you to go on. Challenge yourself to see how you would survive. Most of our players have kept up the habits they learned in this game. So for the next world-saving game, we decided to aim higher, bigger problem than just peak oil. We did a game called Superstruct at the Institute for the Future. And the premise was a supercomputer has calculated that humans have only 23 years left on the planet. The supercomputer was called the Global Extinction Awareness System, of course. And we asked people to come online, almost like a Jerry Bruckheimer movie. You know Jerry Bruckheimer movies? You form a dream team. You've got the astronaut, the scientist, the ex-convict, and they all have something to do to save the world. But in our game, instead of just having five people on the dream team, we said everybody's on the dream team, and it's your job to invent the future of energy, the future of food, the future of health, the future of security, and the future of the social safety net. We had 8,000 people play that game for 8 weeks. They came up with 500 insanely creative solutions that you can go online if you Google Superstruct and see. So finally, the last game, we're launching it March 3rd. This is a game done with the World Bank Institute. If you complete the game, you will be certified by the World Bank Institute as a social innovator, class of 2010, working with universities all over sub-Saharan Africa, and we are inviting them to learn social innovation skills. We've got a graphic novel. We've got leveling up in skills like local insight, knowledge networking, sustainability, vision, and resourcefulness. I would like to invite all of you to please share this game with young people anywhere in the world, particularly in developing areas, who might benefit from coming together to try to start to imagine their own social enterprises to save the world. So I'm going to wrap up now. I want to ask a question. What do you think happens next? We've got all these amazing gamers. We've got these games that are kind of pilots of what we might do, but none of them have saved the real world yet. Well, I hope that you will agree with me that gamers are a human resource that we can use to do real world work, that games are a powerful platform for change. We have all these amazing superpowers, blissful productivity, the ability to weave a tight social fabric, this feeling of urgent optimism and the desire for epic meaning. I really hope that we can come together to play games that matter, to survive on this planet for another century. And that's my hope, that you will join me in making and playing games like this. When I look forward to the next decade, I know two things for sure: that we can make any future we can imagine, and we can play any games we want. So I say, let the world-changing games begin. Thank you.
Several years ago here at TIT, Peter Skillman introduced a design challenge called the Marshmallow Challenge. And the idea is pretty simple. Teams of four have to build the tallest freestanding structure out of 20 sticks of spaghetti, 1 yard of tape, 1 yard of string, and a marshmallow. The marshmallow has to be on top. And though it seems really simple, it's actually pretty hard because it forces people to collaborate very quickly. And so I thought this was an interesting idea, and I incorporated it into a design workshop, and it was a huge success. And since then, I've conducted about 70 design workshops across the world with students and designers and architects, even the CTOs of the Fortune 50. And there's something about this exercise that reveals very deep lessons about the nature of collaboration, and I'd like to share some of them with you. So normally, most people begin by orienting themselves to the task. They talk about it, they figure out what it's going to look like, they jockey for power, then they spend some time planning, organizing, they sketch in, they lay out spaghetti. They spend the majority of their time assembling the sticks into ever-growing structures, and then finally, just as they're running out of time, someone takes out the marshmallow, and then they gingerly put it on top, and they stand back, and ta-da! They admire their work. But what really happens most of the time is that the ta-da turns into an uh-oh, because the weight of the marshmallow causes the entire structure to buckle and to collapse. So there are a number of people who have a lot more uh-oh moments than others. And among the worst are recent graduates of business school. It's amazing. They lie, they cheat, they get distracted, and they produce really lame structures. And of course, there's teams that have a lot more ta-da structures. And among the best are recent graduates of kindergarten. And it's pretty amazing, as Peter tells us. Not only do they produce the tallest structures, but they're the most interesting structures of them all. So the question you want to ask is, how come? Why? What is it about them? And Peter likes to say that none of the kids spend any time trying to be CEO of Spaghetti Inc., right? They don't spend time jockeying for power. But there's another reason as well. And the reason is that business students are trained to find the single right plan, right? And then they execute on it. And then what happens is when they put the marshmallow on top, they run out of time. And what happens? It's a crisis. Sound familiar, right? Okay. What kindergartners do differently is that they start with the marshmallow and they build prototypes, successive prototypes, always keeping the marshmallow on top. So they have multiple times to fix and they build prototypes along the way. So designers recognize this type of collaboration as the essence of the iterative process. And with each version, kids get instant feedback about what works and what doesn't work. So the capacity to play and prototype is really essential. But let's look at how different teams perform. So the average for most people is around 20 inches. Business school students, about half of that. Lawyers, a little better, but not much better than that. Kindergartens, better than most adults. Who does the very best? Architects and engineers, thankfully. And inches is the tallest structure I've seen. And why is it? Because they understand triangles and self-reinforcing geometrical patterns are the key to building stable structures. So CEOs, a little bit better than average, but here's where it gets interesting. If you put an executive admin on the team, they get significantly better. It's incredible. You know, you look around, you go, oh, that team's going to win. You can just tell beforehand. And why is that? Because they have special skills of facilitation. They manage the process. They understand the process. And any team who manages and pays a close attention to work will significantly improve the team's performance. Specialized skills and facilitation skills, the combination leads to strong success. If you have 10 teams that typically perform, you'll get maybe six or so that have standing structures. And I tried something interesting. I thought, let's up the ante once. So I offered a $10,000 prize of software to the winning team. So what do you think happened to these design students? What was the result? Here's what happened. Not one team had a standing structure. Not one had if anyone had built, say, a one-inch structure, they would have taken home the prize. So isn't it interesting that high stakes have a strong impact? We did the exercise again with the same students. What do you think happened then? So now they understand the value of prototyping. So the same team went from being the very worst to being among the very best. They produced the tallest structures in the least amount of time. So there's deep lessons for us about the nature of incentives and success. So you might ask, why would anyone actually spend time running a marshmallow challenge? And the reason is I help create digital tools and processes to help teams build cars and video games and visual effects. And what the marshmallow challenge does is it helps them identify the hidden assumptions. Because frankly, every project has its own marshmallow, doesn't it? The challenge provides a shared experience, a common language, a common stance to build the right prototype. And so this is the value of the experience of this so simple exercise. And those of you who are interested may want to go to marshmallowchallenge.com. It's a blog that you can look at how to build the marshmallows or step-by-step instructions on this. There are crazy examples from around the world of how people tweak and adjust the system. There's world records that are on this as well. And the fundamental lesson, I believe, is that design truly is a contact sport. It demands that we bring all of our senses to the task and that we apply the very best of our thinking, our feeling, and our doing to the challenge that we have at hand. And sometimes a little prototype of this experience is all that it takes to turn us from an uh-oh moment to a ta-da moment, and that can make a big difference. Thank you very much.